I'm delighted now to welcome Mark Nelson. He's an environmental engineer. He's the author of the new book, The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving the Planet One Flush at a Time. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock and then also this Saturday at the Farmers Market Pavilion from 9 till noon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure to be here.
So you are a New York City boy. At a certain point when you were fairly young, you went west and got really interested in all sorts of environmental issues in a very hands-on way. What happened?
Well, I decided the slogan of the 60s, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution, had to apply to myself. And I heard about this innovative group of people who had just recently started Synergy or Ranch, just 20 miles outside of Santa Fe. And, you know, this is the time, this is 1969, the environmental movement is beginning, Earth Day is moving. And when I came out here, you know, I had never seen such desolate, you know, desertified country. And the task that we set ourselves was, can we live intensively, have all kinds of shops, build buildings, and not be a drain on the environment, but actually create an oasis?
I think it's really important to point out also that the desert that you found when you came out here wasn't just the way the land was. The land had really been degraded.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You read accounts of New Mexico, I think even in the late 19th century, that grass in places was up, you know, halfway up the side of a horse. And there was just such intense overgrazing and mismanagement of the land. Yeah, this you know, people often say that we live in Santa Fe, it's a desert. Well, not really. It's a high-temperate grassland. It's semi-arid, but it should be much more luxuriant. But we're seeing basically a couple of centuries of overgrazing and loss of topsoil.
And in the case of where you were at Synergia Ranch, which is still there and thriving, by the way, it was a sheep farm.
Yeah, the whole La Cienega area had apparently 100,000 sheep in its heyday, so it's hard to imagine because there's so little grass left there and the arroyos are burgeoning. So the first thing that we decided is we have to make soil to replace all that topsoil that's been lost.
So this, not only the grass was lost, but the topsoil from which it grew.
Yeah, you know, once you lose the topsoil, then you lose the vegetation. So it's not like cactus isn't part of this environment. But when you look out at a New Mexico landscape and you see a lot of cactus, that's a telltale sign that degradation has happened. And it's happened on almost every acre of New Mexico.
So here you are, young man out west, and you are part of a group that is trying to take a piece of really kind of desolate land and regenerate soil and plant things and have kind of a thriving oasis in this desert. What did you do? What were the actual activities?
Well, it's really a testimony. It's why, in a way, it's the beginning of the Wastewater Gardener poop power. We had a lot of domestic animals, and we assiduously composted that. We also had outhouses, and we made, I guess, what's now called humanure. And we composted that, and for health reasons, we separated that, and we put that underneath fruit trees. So we composted all of our own and our domestic animal wastes.
Not to mention the racetrack nearby.
Oh, yes. And then there was a project. We had planted about 1,000 shade, windbreak, and probably maybe 100 fruit trees around the ranch, but we had the idea of having a really large orchard, a 5-acre orchard with 450 trees. And happily, there were 1,200 horses resident at Santa Fe Downs.
And they just allowed you to come in and truck this manure away. Now, you mentioned that you separated human manure, so to speak, human manure and animal. Why was that?
Well, you know, when you're dealing with this subject, especially human waste, you know, you can't be careless about it. There are pathogens, disease-causing agents in there.
So in both human and animal?
Well, what's really of concern is human waste, animal waste as well. I mean, the real prescription is compost it, because in the heat of a compost heap, the pathogens are killed, the bad bacteria. And also with time, those bacteria live in our gut, in our system. They die over time. But the further precaution is, instead of putting that anywhere near leafy vegetables or a vegetable garden, if you work it into the soil underneath a fruit tree, you have beautiful separation. The fruit is borne high above the ground.
There is a real phobia of human waste that you write about in your book. Diaper phobia is one of the names that you give it. How valid is that phobia? In other words, if you take human waste and you compost it versus if you take horse manure and you compost it, can you get rid of the pathogens either way and truly use it as proper compost, soil, and fertilizer, or is it just too dangerous?
I'm still of the school that you want to be play things safe and conservative. So, and there's wonderful books that deal only with how to make humanure. But really, the safe idea with it is to make sure that the compost, you know, gets hot enough, that you leave it for 6 months or a year to make sure that the pathogens don't survive. And then we have plenty of other uses for good soil. Compost makes soil than putting it into a vegetable garden. And that's why when I did Constructed Wetlands, our rule of thumb is there's never any exposed wastewater. So no one ever has, by accident, touches the sewage.
You worked then at Synergia Ranch for years and saw these little fruit tree seedlings grow into an orchard and really change the landscape.
Yeah, I mean, you know, back to our original goal of creating an oasis. When we came there, you know, I was also doing landscaping. You'd put down a log, and within a few weeks, you'd get a pile of topsoil. There was that much topsoil blowing around the ranch.
And it was blowing around the ranch just because it was eroding off the ground?
Yeah, you know, in fact, if your listeners haven't done that, kind of, you know, stop anywhere and go out into some New Mexico landscape, and you'll find that the sparse vegetation stands up a half inch to 1 inch around the surrounding ground. And what caused that is all the topsoil in between those little clumps of, you know, pretty low level, you know, pasture grasses. They've washed and blown away.
And so there was this process, and after what, 5 years, how long did it take to where you saw a really big difference?
Well, it was kind of gradual. I would say about a decade in, the trees began. So we plant, you know, the core of it was making, we probably made 500 tons of compost with the assist of the racetrack manure.
And you were the compost man.
Yeah, I was kind of the horse poop king of New Mexico for a couple of years there.
And that was like some version of that was your nickname.
Yeah, and probably people want to know that if you're looking for a source of it, if you have a neighbor with a horse, on average a horse produces 17,000 pounds of manure a year.
That's 50 pounds a day.
Yes.
That's crazy.
It is kind of crazy. But they're big animals, and that's why, you know, they eat a lot of hay or a lot of grass. Yeah, so the trees began the process. You know, not only are they growing, but they're sheltering and dropping leaves on the ground. And I like to say, you know, when you come out to Synergia Ranch, even the quality of the so-called weeds has improved. We couldn't plant grass. Now, you know, a lot of native grasses have volunteered, and they're underneath the shade of our windbreak and our fruit trees.
Which is a testament to resilience, the fact that those native grasses just survive in seed form for God knows how many decades.
Yeah, the thing about it is the destruction of the biosphere and of New Mexico's ecology is fairly recent in ecological history. And the really good news is that there's an enormous amount of resiliency. You know, so restoring, you know, ecosystems and restoring the biosphere, this can be done.
We're talking to Mark Nelson about his book, The Wastewater Gardener. So let's talk about wastewater gardens and basically constructed wetlands.
Yeah, so after my experience at Synergia Ranch, I went into Biosphere 2, and one of my jobs was to take care of our sewage system. I was the sewage manager of a small world. And we had worked with a NASA researcher, Bill Wolverton, who is a pioneer in constructed wetlands. And I absolutely fell in love with that system. It was, you know, basically green, beautiful plants, both floating plants and emergent wetland species. And they were turning all of our waste and even our laboratory and domestic animal waste into a beautiful little ecosystem that attracted frogs and ladybugs. And we fed the vegetation to our domestic animals, so we got more eggs, meat, and milk from it. And what was also beautiful in a small world like Biosphere 2 was the remaining nutrients after the constructed wetland went back to our farm. So all of the nutrients went back into the soil.
Now, you were part of Biosphere 2. You were actually one of the very few people who was inside this completely man-made ecosystem in Arizona for 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we were called Biospherians, which is a word that I really like, because guess what? The big biosphere has a crew. And that means that each and every one of us is a biospherian of our large world.
Which is Biosphere 1, which is basically the planet on which we live.
Right, right. So we're in the process, as we did in Biosphere 2, of figuring out an operating manual. You remember the Bucky Fuller operating manual for Spaceship Earth? Well, one of the great thrills about Biosphere 2 is literally, especially because we were the first crew of people in there, we had to write the operating manual and figure out how to operate and live sustainably and happily with our biospheric system.
And that was the solution to human waste, is having a wetland. What in that particular atmosphere that you created in the biosphere, what kind of plants were optimal, and how did you figure that out? Plants that would grow in essentially a sewage conversion wetland.
Well, you know, there's a lot of experience. Constructed wetlands probably date back into the 1950s and 60s. A couple of researchers in Germany are credited with it. So there was a lot of research on the topic. And, you know, what I love about constructed wetlands is you can do it anywhere in the world. But the choice of plants obviously depends on the climate. And in Biosphere 2, we're actually kind of warm to subtropical. So a lot of the plants that we grew, you actually can't grow outside here in New Mexico, but beautiful canna lilies and typha and water hyacinth was one of our floating plants. Even though it was a fairly small system in fiberglass tanks, we had about 15 different types of wetland species in there.
And then the plants are part of the cycle. I mean, I think what this book and what your work reminds us, and which we've really gotten far away from, is that we're all part of a cycle. We produce what we call waste, but is actually fertilizer. The plants then produce what might then be feed for an animal, and it all goes around.
Yeah, exactly. And I hope what people would get from reading this book is both a kind of a global view of the situation with sewage on all levels in the developed world, in wealthy countries, and in the developing world, but also some history of how we got that this is a taboo, and a lot of the traditional reverence and use of these products, which are ultimately a renewable natural resource. Wherever you have people, you can count on having waste products, you know.
And those waste products have, at different times in history, been actually worth money.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a picture in there from a wonderful book called Farmers of 40 Centuries, and it kind of documents, this is around the turn of the 20th century, traditional agriculture in China, Japan, and Korea. And the author, meticulous Western scientist, American scientist, documented, for example, the city of Shanghai collected what was called night soil, the wastes of all of the human inhabitants, and Shanghai was a big city.
So that night soil is just what you and I might call sewage.
Yeah, or poop, or
yeah,
whichever euphemism you want to use. So that was not a cost to the city. They sold it to boatmen who then took it upriver and sold it to farmers who eagerly, you know, bought it, composted it, and put it back on the field. So in Asia to this day, words for poop and caca, it's never associated with a bad thing.
How did it become associated with a bad thing or become taboo here?
Well, in the West, as we began to get really large cities and there wasn't effective ways of moving that waste out, you can imagine how stinky European and American cities were getting. I mean, there were pigs in the streets of New York City as late as the early years of the 1900s, you know, cleaning up a lot of the garbage and the sewage. So a decision was made because badly treated or untreated wastes do spread disease, that what needed to happen, it was kind of a paradigm of that era. Let's make a big factory, now called a sewage treatment plant, and let's pump mixed with water to move that stuff, all of the city's waste, to a distant, hopefully downwind from you, sewage treatment plant. And then after spending a lot of money, resources, energy to detoxify it, it gets dumped into rivers, lakes, or the ocean. So it's a very wasteful process. To their credit, they really reduced, the degree of epidemics and the spread of disease.
Yeah, that and chlorination.
Yeah, and then, of course, we sterilize it in the West. And this is, the story about sewage, which is a catastrophe in a way, it's a catastrophe of wasted resources in the West, in the United States. And in the developing world, it's even more of a catastrophe because they can't afford that type of solution. And untreated sewage pollutes drinking water and so is indirectly responsible for a huge amount of disease and death.
And as you write about, you went to places like the Yucatan Peninsula and to Bali, where the problem gets compounded very rapidly when tourists find out about some kind of island paradise or tropical paradise, and tourists use way more water than native inhabitants, and suddenly you've got a huge waste problem.
Yeah. Well, it exacerbates. It's not a great situation there as well. I mean, there's 3 million people, Balinese, on a pretty small island, and they use their rivers both as bathrooms and places to bathe. So it's not a great situation, but then you put Western tourists, and the irony is Western tourists, for example, in the Yucatan, beautiful, spectacular coral reef offshore. Many people go there to snorkel and to dive. And, you know, when we arrived there, there was no sewage treatment, really. People said they had septic tanks, but they weren't even septic tanks. They didn't have a bottom. And in that limestone ecology of the Yucatan, that waste was going just like, you know, through a highway out to the water.
How does that affect the coral reefs?
Well, it's very bad for coral reefs. The coral reefs are, it's kind of like the paradox of the rainforest. Really luxuriant, you know, some people call it the corals a rainforest of the ocean. But both systems, coral reefs have to be in very low nutrient waters. Otherwise, algae overgrow the coral and you get very bad things.
Right. You decided at a certain point, after doing a lot of hands-on work at Synergia Ranch and at Biosphere 2, that you would go back and get advanced degrees. What did you study? What did it look like?
Well, I did a master's in the School of Renewable Natural Resources, basically studying constructed wetlands, and then I was lucky enough to work with H.T. Odum, who's actually the founder of ecological engineering, which I think is it's part of the paradigm change that makes me not optimistic, but saying, you know, if we exercise some intelligence, we actually could really reverse the damage that's been done and we can recreate the earth that we all want to live on. I worked with his group at the Center for Wetlands at the University of Florida and did a PhD in environmental engineering.
And Florida's a place where, in theory, constructed wetlands would be extremely effective.
Yeah, I mean, among my inspirations is the city of Orlando, not my favorite city in the world, but they have two constructed wetlands, one 1,000 acres and one 1,500 acres, that are absolutely beautiful recreation areas, beautiful constructed wetlands that people use for biking and hiking and most people are unaware that they are also sewage treatment wetlands. So it was kind of an inspiration in my line of business. If people don't smell the poop, if they just look and see a beautiful garden, then you know we've done our job well.
How is it that you have a constructed wetland, which is essentially a natural sewage treatment facility, and you don't smell the poop?
Because there's a number of this, a little bit technical engineering, but this is what's lovely about ecological engineering. You use natural mechanisms. So the main driver of a constructed wetland is sunshine, gravity, and you know the time-honed ability of plants and microbes to take all the wonderful nutrients in our wastes and turn them into beautiful gardens. But you do engineering. So I chose to use what's called subsurface flow wetlands. People may know them as reed beds, but basically you don't use soil. You have a liner, you know, like a pond liner or out of concrete in developing countries, and you fill it up with gravel. But you make the level of the gravel about 2 inches above the level of the water. And 2 inches of gravel means you don't smell that wastewater. And we just ensure that at every stage, I'm very big now on at the final stage, not disposing of it, because sewage and extra nutrients cause damage to both land and water systems, but to use it as subsoil irrigation. So again, the magic is if the irrigation is subsoil, subsurface, you don't smell it, and now you can plant anything that you want. In the constructed wetland, you have to have plants that can live in water.
We're talking to Mark Nelson about his book, The Wastewater Gardener. You then started going all around the world both to see what they were doing and to construct wetlands.
Yeah, and one of the things, let me just reinforce, when I came out of Biosphere 2, I mean, it was such a rich experience, you know, living so intimately with a living system. And what partly inspired me was looking at the 500,000 visitors we had during those 2 years. They were watching me wading in our system. It was not a subsurface flow wetland, but it was a beautiful system. And I could see that the tour guide was probably saying, and there's one of the biospherians, and he's harvesting, you know, wetland plants, and that's our sewage system. And they were, like, incredulous. And I began to think, well, you know, one of the problems that we have in this big biosphere is how do we get connected in a real way to some of the basics, like our water system, what happens to our waste. And what I love about wastewater gardens is you can do it, and has been done for cities of up to 20 and 30,000 people, but you can also do it for an individual house or a cluster of houses or a small hotel. And then the people who, you know, we're talking about tourists, people who go down to the Yucatan can rest assured that if their hotel has got a constructed wetland or a wastewater garden, and we built 30 or 40 systems along that coast, they won't be swimming with what they flush down their toilet.
How does it work in climates where it's cold half the year and frozen for, you know, 3, 4, 5 months a year?
Yeah, I mean, well, the funny thing, as I mentioned, the modern technology was developed in Germany, which has very severe winters. So one of the engineering things is, depending on how cold the winter is, you may need more space. In general, in a cold climate, you need 2 or 3 times the area as you do in a warm tropical area. But curiously enough, most of the treatment happens by the microbes. And because our water comes out from a house, you know, warm water full of nutrient-rich wastes, that process can continue. In fact, they say in really cold climates, when there's ice or snow over the system, that's a little bit of insulation, and the sewage actually meets regulatory standards even during the winter.
Are there constructed wetlands here in New Mexico for sewage treatment?
Yeah, there's a number. There's a wonderful number of firms have been doing them, and my understanding, we have one at the ranch. I actually do most of my work elsewhere in the world, but I believe New Mexico has some pretty sensible regulations about, especially, you know, for private homes, that you can do what's called on-site sewage treatment, and constructed wetlands are certainly one of the choices.
How big for a house with, let's say, two or three people living in it, how much space do you need to make that work outside of your house?
Well, you know, the area depends on how concentrated the nutrients in the sewage is, the quantities, etc. But let me hasten to say that the book talks about many new developments that are part of the overall solution to, you know, again, treating all of our waste as a great resource and ways of restoring the health of our soils and increasing the greenery. You really don't want to have you don't need to have a wastewater garden or a constructed wetland unless there's really a danger that your sewage is going to pollute the groundwater. So for a lot of people in New Mexico, when our groundwater is 100, 200, even 300 feet deep, you know, I'm much more for using gray water land irrigation, treating it and then using it in a much less expensive way.
Using gray water.
Yeah, using gray water irrigation. And the really good thing is that, you know, modern architects tend to separate the black water, meaning the toilet water, from, you know, your laundry and showers and sinks, etc. And it's much easier to use the nutrients in gray water.
You found yourself in Australia and have spent a lot of time and done a lot of projects there.
Yeah, through my institute, the Institute of Ecotechnics, I left New Mexico in 1978 to begin a wonderful project, kind of doing the restoration work we were doing in Sinergia Ranch, but this time up in the northwest of Australia. And as you get up in the north of Australia, it's tropical. It's tropical savanna. It's grassland. So in a way, it was beautiful for me, you know, learning the trade of being an ecologist, because kind of New Mexico, the story of devastation, overgrazing, and land degradation, but in a tropical environment.
Yeah. And so what were some of the projects that you did there?
Well, you know, luckily enough, after I'd had the experience in Biosphere 2 and then with the graduate work in Mexico work, began to be a jack of all trades and actually, you know, putting constructed wetlands in, we worked with a number of Aboriginal communities who usually have appalling sewage systems. And we put in these beautiful systems. In some communities, we had the Aboriginal artists do Dreamtime images on our control box and tried to get them to really own, you know, since it was beautifying their community.
I mean, that's the thing about these wetlands, is that they're beautiful. They attract wildlife. They grow trees. They attract birds. They are food. They're essentially nature.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's in the book I talk about. I've had a love affair, I guess, for the last 20 or 30 years, both with natural wetlands, and they're magic. You know, they're so different in every region that you go to. But constructed wetlands, it's just like, you know, people fall in love with the roses and the flowers and the fruit trees in their backyard. And I think that was kind of the recipe that I really wanted to do, is to make irresistibly beautiful and diverse wastewater gardens. And we called it wastewater gardens kind of to shock people.
Right.
It's not a reed bed. And unfortunately, constructed wetlands are usually put in by engineers, and they're just looking at, you know, the simplest system that does the efficient job.
Engineers don't have art training, and they should.
They should. I mean, one of the wonderful things about Biosphere 2 is that we had to get a group of great engineers working with great ecologists. And the ecologists had to learn the language of engineering so that it could speak to them and tell them what they needed. And the engineers, once they got over their shock that they weren't in charge of everything, loved learning ecology, and that every solution that they made had to, one, serve an ecological function and be sustainable. You were saying it really well in our global biosphere, but even more in a small one, everything cycles. There aren't wastes. The output from one system has to be absorbed by another. So I think, by the way, I think that's one of the problems in our world, is we have engineering schools and we have ecology schools and we have art schools.
Right.
And, you know, being naive to all of this, I thought, why can't we engineer constructed wetlands to be ecological and beautiful?
Yeah, naivete can be a beautiful thing. Well, and it also, what you're talking about and the work you're doing points out something that has become a kind of reflex, I think, for so many people in the world, which is machines will do a better job.
Yeah, we sometimes joke that, you know, our systems in a way are too inexpensive and they're too simple, that we should put a lock on our control box, which really just has a pipe to send overflow to our final green, you know, green irrigation area, and you know, tell people that there are all kinds of fancy equipment in there, or maybe even, you know, go down to Radio Shack and get a dummy board with flashing lights so people could satisfy their technophilia.
Well, and I mean, it's inexpensive for a number of reasons, including the fact that when it's done, it not only maintains itself, but adapts to change.
Yeah, I mean, the lovely thing, I'd liken it to, you know, if you buy a car, it's going to be pretty flawless and pretty problem-free for the first X number of years. And then any piece of equipment, any machinery, you could expect to be replacing parts, fiddling with it, taking it to a mechanic, ultimately replacing it. The really beautiful thing about constructed wetlands, they get better as the plants get more developed, and they can last, you know, decade after decade after decade. So in the developing world, this becomes a very attractive way. It's really a crisis. I think people have said 95% of the sewage in the developing world is untreated. That's why, you know, the water is, drinking water is so polluted.
So what are the barriers toward every community, every city in the developing world to doing a wastewater garden of some kind?
Well, you know, a lot of these countries, the fact that it's less expensive, there's still some cost in it. You know, so what we'd like to do, for example, we did a project in Algeria, and both by our wish and by the instructions of the Algerian government, we did workshops for local engineers to teach them how to do it. I mean, one of my favorite pictures and experiences in the book was me 5 feet down a hole in the back of our homestead in Australia, digging out our first wastewater garden. So, you know, if you have people and, you know, they can find the gravel, you know, they can make a liner, it can be made quite inexpensive. And the really good news is that this technology is spreading throughout the world.
What about big cities? What about Tokyo, Mexico City, New York, Chicago?
Ah, there's the rub. Yes, the problem with constructed wetlands is you need an area to make it. This is why in the United States, generally, you know, when communities had to pay for their own sewage treatment in the 70s and 80s, it was mostly, curiously enough, rural communities in the South who did a good, simple, straightforward cost-benefit analysis, and they saw that making constructed wetlands was way cheaper than having these fancy-dancy mechanical systems. But they had the land just out the city. So, yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about that because really, you know, where does our food come from, you know, in Tokyo or New York or Santa Fe? It comes from farms. And if we're not getting those nutrients back, so I talk at some length and just point out that one of the engineering that we have to redo is that we mix residential sewage, you know, i.e. your and mine, with that of industry and businesses and dry cleaners and God knows what. And that makes the sludge really dicey.
Well, super toxic.
Yeah.
I mean, even in our house, I, like probably a lot of other people listening today, clean my paintbrushes with mineral spirits and wash
and
that stuff
down
the drain.
Yes, yes. One of the things that we do when we put constructed wetlands in, but then you have a willing audience, is you say, you see that lovely garden in the back? It really doesn't want to have your paint thinner or
right.
Your oil change. You know, the fact that it's a drain, I mean, what I've discovered around the world, and even in the United States, one quarter of the population is on septic tanks. But a lot of people on septic tanks haven't a clue about how it works. So they wind up killing the bacteria in their septic tank, and then they go and buy useless but expensive bacteria so they can feel in control. But once they stop making war on the system. So I think, you know, once we can separate, and this will be a retrofit, but, you know, this is not rocket science. We made these problems. now that we're starting to change our thinking about it, and the global water shortage is perfect, you know, incentive to change the way we think about, we shouldn't have a word called wastewater.
Yeah.
That we can change that. And if cities then separate their residential and get business to pay for, which will incentivize them using less toxic materials and properly cleaning it, then that sludge or the remnants can be sent back to the farms. And I think that needs to be subsidized, because I'm really happy everyone says the word sustainable. When you start thinking about what would make our world sustainable, it's making that connection between the cities and the nutrients that came from the farms.
Mark Nelson is an environmental engineer. He's author of the book, The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving the Planet One Flush at a Time. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock speaking and signing books, and he will also be at the Farmers Market Pavilion this Saturday from 9 until noon. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
And let's mention you've got two websites, wastewatergardens.com, which is about this whole phenomenon of wastewater gardening, and your...
With pictures of many of the systems we've done around the world, etc.
Okay, and you also have a website for the book, which is wastewatergardener.com.
Right.
Good. Well, thanks again. We'll see you at Collected Works tonight.